I started thinking about suicide when I was 12. But this morning, where the Prozac finally did something, I woke up and was just energized, jazzed, happy to be alive. I mean, I went through this alphabet soup of medications, never quite getting back to that one little window, that one Prozac week where everything was golden. And I decided that I had had enough. And I went into the bathroom and I tried to take my own life. So I consulted with him, and he is a practitioner, one of the few, of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, formerly known as shock therapy. It floods your body with a number of chemicals and also largely just reboots the electrical system. And now I have zero doubt. Every day I wake up, I have a reason to wake up. I have three reasons to wake up.
I'm David Neiman.
And I'm Karen Basson.
And you're listening to A Better Pill to Swallow. So before I introduce our next guest, who I am particularly excited about, I want to give a disclaimer to our listeners, which is that Karen and I have unearthed who has to be the chattiest non-Jew on the planet. I don't really hang out with people that are chattier than me. I would put Karen probably on like the equal playing field, but there's very few where I'm like, wow, you're chattier than me and I love you. Whenever it's you're chattier than me, it ends with, I'm going to kill you. But this is a guy who can and will talk your ear off, and you're going to love every minute of it. Probably one of, let me just say, so I don't get in trouble later, favorite in-law. And when I say in-law, I mean married in from an old friend of mine. He came with the package from another old friend, and we'll explore that later. Randall.
Hello.
Ta-da!
I'm so tempted to only answer in like one word responses now after that intro.
He just thought he was chatty because David's so chatty and he just wants to talk the whole time. Right.
I just nod a lot. That's all. Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me. I love the concept of this show.
If you could tell us what that is, I would love that. If you could write it down.
I mean, at first, listen, any conversation about mental health is the right conversation to have. I mean, the more people talk about it in relation to themselves and to the people around them, the better off we will all be. I think it's something that's been done to some degree, but a lot of it's under the guise of like these rules and this is how you talk about mental health. And I think just kind of getting wet and getting dirty about it is the best way to do it.
Well, that is what I was spotlighting in the first episode, which is that I actually, and I don't know if I mentioned this part, I've seen such an enormous change from how taboo it felt when Andy thought he was the Messiah in 1995 and I told everybody he had mental illness. It was one of those, oh, okay, and we won't talk about it in respect to you and I'm uncomfortable. You know, that's the sense that we got. My mom even lost like a friend to that because of her discomfort. And as then those 20 years went by, it just went from you're weird to, oh my God, I have my brother, my sister, my second cousin's former roommate, you know, like everybody's now dealing with it. And that's the proof right there that I've been able to see with my own eyes because I've been dealing with it for so long with my brother.
And not everybody gets there at the same speed and not everybody gets to the same destination with it. You know, I think people we know are particularly open people, and a lot of us, it's easier to talk about these things because of our own experiences or our own observations. There are people out there, I guarantee you, who are going to listen to this and go, what a crock of shit. Who are these people? Shut up and go back to work. You know, that just have no context with which to enter into or listen to a conversation.
Until their wife loses their mind.
Until that happens. And then then they're going to go, wow, what brilliant people these are that have put together an hour of banter.
I think that it's getting the critical mass, or this topic is reaching fever pitch.
I think we've all recognized almost nobody is without some giant fucking problem. We're all a mess. We're all a mess in some way or another.
Because our world has gotten only more and more difficult, the solution has been to medicate, medicate, medicate. instead of trying to make this world better on the outside, thereby not having to numb it out inside. We just said, okay, let's do scorched earth on the outside. And it's okay because I feel okay because half of my brain is shut down from the medication.
Right. By all means, continue smashing yourself in the head with a hammer. We will supply painkillers for you.
Right.
That's going to solve everything.
Yeah. So let's go back. Chick check, as they say,
check.
As the Hebrews say. Go back. I learned that last week. I learned that in the last podcast.
Well, if you just learned a Hebrew saying, guess who's behind you? Yes. I'm not familiar with that either.
So go back to when we first met was a very, very...
It's the beginning of my mental health crisis, David. That moment, the birth of it all. I was a totally normal person up until that moment.
Yeah. You know, Randall, I wish I could tell you you're the first person to tell me that. We met, and I don't even know if Karen knows this, but we met when Heidi, for those listeners, was his wife.
My now wife.
At that point, best friend of about 5 years. This was 2003. This was the beginning of February of 2003. Fish had just come back, and we were in a fight, and she had not called me back. I had called her so many times. People didn't have cell phones in the same way, and I felt really slighted and sort of betrayed that we were as close as we were. I didn't move to New York for her, but like she was very much in my calculus when I moved from LA to New York. And so when she didn't call me back a number of times, I left a number of messages. I was like, fuck this bitch. And so she finally calls me on the lot because we do have cell phones at this point. I think she may have gotten a cell phone during this time and said, are you here? She just said, are you here? And I said, yes, I'm here. And I was still like, and I'm mad at you. And I'm not ready to make up just because you're, let's not forget what you did. And so I walked up like in a huff, angry that she hadn't called me because we were day-to-day friends. I mean, we were so close. And so I came up not even knowing Rand, never having met him before, just having heard about him because Heidi and I went to the first Bonnaroo. I have like the claim to fame that I went to the first Bonnaroo and only the first Bonnaroo. That was one and done. It's like, I've seen enough.
One is more than enough for most folks.
What is a Bonnaroo?
It's a music festival in Tennessee where debauchery and music are there in equal amounts, basically.
Okay. So you went to one and you were done.
It's a huge music festival. It became an enormous thing. I assume they're doing it now. But the point is that she had mentioned she had met this great new guy. And I wanted to know about this guy. But she didn't talk to me after.
She didn't call you back.
Yet. No. And so I came up. And as soon as I see him, I'm like, oh, God, here we go. He's going to defend her honor. He's going to be mad that I'm mad. And he's going to be like, look, buddy, back off. This is my girl. I'm like, this is my best friend. You were in a fart in the wind when we were friends. Okay, don't do that. We don't have like that kind of thing. We're like buds. And so as soon as I came up, he was just, I don't know exactly what he said, but it was just obviously, Karen, I mean, he was so disarming, obviously. He was just like, you seem like you have a lot of feelings right now. And I want to honor that because I know you're feeling, you know, she hurt your feelings. So let's talk about this in an adult way.
I let you two talk by yourselves for a little bit there. And then when I sensed from afar, you guys went a little three rows away. And then when I sensed that it was starting to get a little too heated, I came back over and then, yeah, I tried to be somewhat disarming. Well, the bitch of it is that I knew that I was largely the reason why she hadn't called you, and not because I had supplanted your friendship, but because I was a hot mess. And she was just dealing with my bullshit. So I could only in good conscience allow.
Oh my God, I didn't know that. So I should be fucking pissed at you.
No, you should be apologizing to me and to her. Yeah, which is not likely to happen, but I'll take the revelation as enough. But
yeah.
Well, that was the story of our early relationship for a long time, exclusive of you as well, is that she spent an awful lot of her time mitigating my troubles and then, you know, being put in awkward positions as a result of it. And that was a shame. It was really great meeting you because I felt like we were going to get along great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was one of those things where as soon as we had our first introduction, I was like, well, I'm still mad at you, but you should marry this guy.
Let's go get a drink and keep talking about it.
Yeah. Well done on that guy. But yeah, so that was how I met you. And I want to go back to you meeting Heidi almost immediately. But I wouldn't mind if we just tell the quick story, because it was very, very cute, of the moment that the two of you met, which I was present for and I was responsible for.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Karen. I thought you were still talking about Heidi. No. Karen. Oh, God. Yes, you were instrumental in my meeting of Karen.
Yes.
I was in no way prepared for Karen. That was fantastic.
It was exactly how I felt when I met Karen. Right.
That's like, oh, no, we'll go back to my place. I'm staying with my friend. We'll just go over there and we'll have another drink. And then you came home from a white hot night of something or other. Some of what? Serving?
She was serving at Gladstone's.
I was, serving still.
Yeah. So you were ready to shed blood that.
Because you were introduced to her on her turf, and it wasn't even, you weren't even a guest of hers. You were my guest. So she was like, I've had the day from hell. I'm in my home. You're a guest of my house guest.
So it's on my terms. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is the way it should have been. Absolutely. And funny enough, I mean, your ferocity, I never felt like was aimed at me. So I was just actually enjoying that. You were like a buffet of angst that I was just kind of enjoying. Like I could listen to.
You kept like cursing out the manager that wasn't here or the clients that weren't there, and then taking a second to apologize to Randall for being that way when you're first meeting. And he's going, not only is it okay, I want to record this so I can play it back later and laugh at it.
My favorite moment of our interaction, and this was like one of those do or die moments for you and I. One point, it got quiet for a minute and I went, so how Jewish are you? And you looked at me and you went, I'm sorry, did you just ask me how fucking Jewish am I? And I went, yes, I did. And here's what I mean by that. There's ethnic Jews, there's religious Jews, you can be Jewish in a number of ways. I was wondering, like, you know, are you practicing? Are you whatever? You know, Jews are on a dial, like a 1 to 9 million. And I just wanted to know where you landed on that dial. But it was a classic.
Yeah. Karen's 9 million when it comes to like the ethnic feeling of being Jewish, not the practicing. Practicing, you're like a 2, but the Jew feeling, you're 9 million, right?
I hope a bunch of sensitive Jews are listening to this at some point going, what the fuck is wrong with these people? But that was a brilliant moment. And I think in the moment when you realized that I was not trying to call you out or pick a fight with you, you went, okay, all right, yeah, we're going to get along.
He looks like a Nazi, but he's nice.
Totally. Oh, God. You know what? Actually, Randall, it was that for me was like really meeting you was at your birthday in Palm Springs. And we had everybody over and Randall, you came and we got to talking and we brought up Holocaust.
I don't like to tiptoe around. Let's dive right in.
Yeah.
We're like into the pool. Oh, it was terrific. But that's when I was like, I'm loving Mr. Randall.
Well, it is likewise, very much likewise.
Yeah. To be open to just speak about it. And it's like this whole thing now to just say it without dancing around the topic or.
Yeah, I quit tiptoeing a long, long time ago. Life's too short to tiptoe around stuff. I mean, I'll be polite.
We both have loved meeting you and becoming your very close friend, as well as my own mother, who continues to visit you. And one of the reasons why, very particular similarity to Andy in that. You have a big fucking brain, you know, like just like standing in your presence. And just like with Andy, you're like, this guy has a big brain. It has a lot of tentacles and it has a lot of prongs. And that's what's so fun about going all those places with you. And also, I think that it can be common when your brain is that big, that it can find some danger spots and some places that are hard to reckon with, which kind of leads into your trials. And so if we could go to even further back to you growing up and you first discovering, oh, I have some more issues than other people.
Yeah, something's up. Yeah. Well, thank you for the compliment, the big brain compliment. I appreciate that. I think you are right. And it's hard to talk about that without sounding like, you know what? I'm really fucking smart. I don't know if you were aware of this, of just how smart I am, but you probably want to listen to what I have to say. No, I mean, I know I'm not an idiot. And I know I'm smarter than the people that I run into on a daily basis, but I'm also a mental dwarf compared to a lot of other people on the planet. So I'm just smart enough to get myself into trouble, I guess is a good way of thinking of it. When I was a kid, I think I was 10, and I remember this night vividly. It was the first night I realized something was amiss. It's one thing to be sad or upset about a circumstance. You know, my toy broke. My friend was mean to me. I got in trouble at school. Those things you can point to and say, that's why I feel the way I feel right now. And there was a night I went to bed responsibly, probably at 9:30 or something like that, age 10. And I laid there in my bed and I couldn't go to sleep. I had that feeling in my stomach, like when you have done something wrong, that guilty gnaw at the guts, you know, and you're like, oh my God, I'm going to have to tell mom that I, you know.
That's Judaism.
Yes, exactly. Something you came by genetically, I had to find my way to, you know, so I'm laying there and I can't go to sleep. And finally, I went and got my mom and I said, look, something's up. She goes, what is it? I said, I got that feeling like when you do something wrong and you know, it's almost like feeling guilty, but I don't have anything to feel guilty about right now. And she, I mean, to her credit, had no idea that this was a larger cry for help. She assumed that I was trying to confess some stupid shit I had done, you know, and she's like, well, what did you do? I said, well, I didn't do anything. You know, this time I didn't do anything.
That she continued to try to pry it out of you?
A little bit, not aggressively, but, you know, I don't know that in her shoes I'd have done anything different. I would not have immediately gone, so you have mental health issues, do you? You know, that would not have crossed my mind, for, you know, as my 10-year-old approaches me, but it was a persistent feeling. And I, you know, I talked to her for a good 20 minutes. And she said, I don't know what to tell you. You know, go to bed, go lay down, work, you know, fall asleep, and eventually it'll go away. And it did in the short run. And then it started coming back more and more off. And I couldn't explain it. I didn't know how to verbalize it. Again, I kept coming back to those bad analogies of like I did something wrong. It was the only, at that point, the only feeling I could equate it with. And it persisted, not every day, all day, but it got more and more frequent and then more and more intense, that feeling. And then it kind of morphed into just a pervasive general feeling of unease and unhappiness.
And this is over how many years now, the era you're speaking to?
From 10 to 13 was kind of a freight elevator up. Every 10 to 13-year-old probably goes through some times where you want to either tear the head off of someone else or tear your own off, you know. But it was inappropriate to the places that I would be. It was not circumstantial. I would find myself in the best of situations and feeling like crap. And that was the puzzling thing. I should be totally jazzed right now. I should be totally happy.
And not reflective of a child at that age. That's the thing. Like, more normal when you're older for that kind of thing to happen, I think.
Yeah, when you got real problems. And there was just never any rhyme or reason to it. If you imagine a pendulum swinging from happy to unhappy, that swing became faster and further each direction over time. You know, like I'd be even more intensely happy at one minute and more intensely, as is an age old story now, but not something that, you know, in the 80s, people were readily identifying or talking about.
No, 80s and in South Carolina?
Yeah. The bustling metropolis that I lived in South Carolina, not known for its addressing mental health. It was very rural.
Or just part of the South, too. I mean,
yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, people are less likely to open up about masculine weakness or emotional issues there than elsewhere. Get my gun, you know.
Right.
That kept happening to me for a long time. And then it kind of got to a point by the time I got to high school where it became clear that something was amiss, you know. And then, you know, one of the prime indicators, and it always has been this for me, is my desire to sleep. I think that was always my go-to self-treatment.
And you were able to?
Oh, able to a fault and at inopportune times. You know, I started falling asleep in class. I could sleep through 4 out of 7 classes in the course of a day, no problem. And then go home, take a nap, eat dinner, and then want to go to sleep again.
And you would always sleep through the night?
Yeah. There were times where, you know, as you do when you're young, I could stay up all night, you know, just doing whatever. But in general, that became more and more of the pattern. I just was constantly exhausted.
Right. But that's also connected because when you're that age, the high schoolers are better at sleeping.
But sleeping 14 hours and then waking up and immediately wanting to go back to sleep again was at a point where, and it was then, you know, things were, I started doing poorly in school. And to my mom, that was like, wait, what? We don't do badly in school. This is not something that's allowed, you know, or even conceivable. So, I mean, I guess I was in my early teens the first time I went to a psychiatrist and they tried with me Prozac to start. Good old Prozac. they died prior to handing me medication. They made an attempt at diagnosis and they said, you know, depression. And that was this big broad brush. It covered just about anything abnormal. I hadn't heard the word bipolar. I don't know if it was even in use at that point. Certainly not broadly. There was depression. And then God help you, there was manic depression was, you know, like, ooh, it means it's really bad is what most people would just assume. But they said, you.
And what did they diagnose you with? Only depression?
Depression. We're going to treat your depression. And those were interesting.
Randall, were you having episodes where you were manic and up and excited? And
well, so to clarify, let's talk about labels for a minute.
Sure.
Even bipolar is an improper and incomplete label, right? Just like autism is an incomplete and so beyond general. And even in that, there are people over time, they'll come with these refinements. There's, you know, type 1 bipolar, type 2 bipolar. And those are great generalizations. And you have to develop a vocabulary to address these things, or else you walk around in confusion with everybody. No one can name anything. But even those names are dismissive to, I think, the spectrum of disorder that's out there. Any more than you can say autistic refers to the entire spectrum of people that are now, you know, put on it. There's such vast variations on that theme. And I think the same is true for bipolar. I was never one of those. I was not your type 1 bipolar where I'm like, you know, I was not Andy. I never thought it was God. I never, you know, hallucinated. I never stayed up for 72 hours straight or anything like that. I was much more on the depressive end of that.
But when you would get depressed,
that's when it got deeper and deeper and deeper.
And it could get really, really dark.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I started thinking about suicide when I was 12, you know, which come to find out is far more common than I think anybody realized. I mean, now you
certainly today.
Yeah. You read, you know, polls of students in seventh and eighth grade and how many of them considered suicide or have thought about it in some way. It's terrifying.
Well, that's ballooned considerably in the modern era.
I wonder, has it ballooned or do we just know more about it?
Well, teen suicide and
now the cyberbullying and all this extra stuff on social, like it just made it worse. But
yeah, you are right. You are right. It is more. I think it's been out there for a long time under the surface that more so than any of us probably realized. You know, I sure didn't want to tell my mom that. I mean, I was 3-4 years of thinking about it before I ever admitted to my family that the thought had crossed my mind because I knew it was going to crush them. Just the thought that I was thinking about it.
But how could they? I mean, your mom is a pretty bright woman, and I met an old version of her. How would she not be aware and seeing from the sidelines?
Because I lied about it.
I know, but you can only lie about it, I would imagine, for so long before she doesn't buy your story.
I took great pains not to let anything show that that was something that was on my mind. It was impossible to hide that things weren't right, but I just didn't want to throw the weight on anybody else of any day now. I may just decide as my last day. That's a crap load of weight to put on someone else was how I saw it, you know?
And it's so much to put on yourself.
Yeah, but I was stuck with it. I didn't have to share it was my thought, you know, like, why am I going to wreck everybody else's day with my garbage? I did a lot of that. I never wanted to be the problem in the room for anybody, you know? And so often I am the problem in the room, you know? I think there's a lot of people like that. Who we are with the people who are nearest and dearest to us is, I think, by definition, different from who we are with the people out in the world, right? So I could go to school and...
True about me, but that's true about most people.
No, you are a dick to everybody. I mean, without fail. And I say this on radio with a smile on my face that probably doesn't come across.
Right. As the people in the background cheer.
They're probably becoming clear.
You can hear they're cheering now.
I would present as one person to the people at school and then to my friends. I was a different person. And then I was a different person to my family. And I think we all probably do that to some degree. Just it's your protective coloration. And
sure. Even I do that to a degree. Yes.
Yeah. Your professional persona or.
And this didn't get in the way. I was about to ask you, and it feels related. This didn't get in the way of you fostering friendships at school.
Oh, it did. I didn't have really very many friends to speak of. I was the school nerd. I had no friends for many, many, many years. It's difficult sometimes to separate situational depression from chronic organic depression. You know what I mean? So I had something to be a little less than thrilled about in that I got teased and mocked every day for being the idiot in the room who would open his mouth. Well, Mrs. Smith, as a matter of fact, I know the answer to that question, and let me tell you why.
You sound exactly like a Simpsons character, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, I was short a bow tie from being actually murdered.
Right. You didn't get the memo after the first three times you were thrown in a trash can?
Well, see what happened. No, I did get the memo, but I grew up in a tiny town. And so once you got stamped, you know, there was just no shaking it for the rest of your life.
So you're like, I'm going to own this now.
I had to eventually, you know, and I basically just went with a fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. You're cool. Fuck you. You know, so I didn't have friends to speak of. In high school, I had a very tight core group of guys that I met that were also kind of on the nerdy side of things. And so we bonded well enough together. And it was an insulation against the social disaster that was my life otherwise. And now I just know even more nerds. And so I've evolved to the man you see before me by surrounding myself with nerds such that I don't have to deal with people who aren't. Yeah, at any rate, I mean, I just kept muscling through, you know, I mean, I knew things were wrong. And then when we got into the medication world.
You start Prozac at age 13?
You know what? I'm terrible with time, but probably 15 or 16, I think.
And what does it feel like?
Nothing at first. It's a slow burn kind of thing. It takes, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for it to kind of ramp up, you know, your serotonin levels and
melt your brain, right?
Yeah, before you actually have the seizure. The first, I mean, I woke up one day and felt markedly different and was energetic waking up. If you were to inventory my entire life, I think there have been like 4 days where I woke up and went, yeah, let's go. You know, I have always been a slow starter. I mean, usually I will continue to roll over until some situation forces me to get out of bed. But this morning where the Prozac finally did something, I woke up and was just energized, jazzed, happy to be alive.
That's fantastic. And so, and how long did that take from first day of insertion?
About roughly 6 weeks, I think.
Okay. Like,
they said 4 to 6 and I didn't keep a calendar in those days, but yeah, it was over a month, but less than two.
But there has to be a come down, I feel. So I feel like there has to be now a part where you're like, okay, now nothing's happening anymore.
Well, that did happen. Actually, the reverse is I stayed on that little plateau for a couple of weeks, maybe, and it was amazing. It was like having a brand new life, or certainly a new way to feel about things, you know? And then it pushed into anxiety. It was almost like you did, well, cocaine's a wonderful, terrible thing, and it's great right up until it's horrible, right? I mean, all of a sudden you go from, this is awesome, to what are you looking at? Who are you? You know, and that's kind of how it went. I mean, it's affecting exactly the same things in your brain. I mean, it's very little. The only difference probably is the prescription to some degree. But I'd find myself driving and I'd hit the brakes and I would feel like, oh my God, I'm going to die. Someone's going to rear end me any second. Right. And I had never felt like that before. And it was there was a physicality to that anxiety. Like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. You know, and I was tense more of the time.
Unique and singular when compared to any of the other feelings you had had up until that point.
I had never felt that way in my life ever before. And so immediately I recognize it as this is medication oriented. Something's amiss. So what do? You go back to the doctor.
May cause.
Brain tentacles, you know.
Thinking someone's going to hit you, rear end you.
And so you go back to the doctor as one does. And they say, oh, well, we're going to reduce the dosage. Or increase the dosage, you know, but I think in this case, they said, well, reduce it a little bit, expect 4 to 6 weeks for delivery. So, you know, you suffer through six more weeks and then you go back and you go, now I've like my tongue itches and I don't feel right. And they're like, well, we'll up it halfway back to where you were. Expect 4 to 6 weeks before this takes effect. So before you know it, you're 6 months down the line and you're pissed off about even more things than you were before you started. Not the least of which is that, man, for a minute there, I felt great. Can we just dial in how to get back to that? And then from there, the logical step as a psychiatrist in the 80s and 90s is, you know what you need is another medication on top of it. I can treat that problem. Try this. And so then they added another medication and then that didn't go well. And so I said, what else can we do? Well, we'll take you off of Prozac altogether and then we'll put you on Effexor. And then you take Effexor for 8 million years and then decide that that's not going to work. And then you do the same dosage game. And then they go, well, then we're going to try Zoloft. And then we're going to try Wellbutrin. And then we're going to try. And so, I mean, I went through this alphabet soup of medications, never quite getting back to that one little window, that one Prozac week where everything was golden.
Pharma hot potato is what that sounds like to me.
And I realized at one point, this is the only tool that these people I'm going to have to offer me is this medicine, that medicine, this medicine. I would go to therapists too. And inevitably, I would just find myself kind of just charming the therapist. And then we just talk about the things that we did in our week. And hey, great seeing you again, Dan. This was awesome. You have yourself a great day. And go home and go, did I accomplish anything here? Like, I mean, I know I never had to take an inventory of the good things in my life. I knew what they were. I was surrounded by incredible friends, an incredibly loving family.
And you felt that? Like on an emotional level, not an intellectual level?
I never lost sight of that. Well, from post-high school, when I, you know, early adulthood, I started finding myself surrounded by people like you guys and my now wife and my friends in those days, you know, sort of the college years. I could point to the thousand things that were amazing in my life, still felt like hammered shit half of the time. And that, to me, was the most galling thing, you know? There was guilt. Like I have no right to feel the way I feel.
No gratitude is what you felt.
I did have such gratitude for everybody around me. You know, I mean, this family that would move mountains to love me and lift me up and help me and legitimately enjoyed my company. And that was the most frustrating aspect of it, was to be able to look around and go, everything is right. I feel like hell. I wrote a rambling piece one time. And this image that kept popping into my head was the rot in the rose. Like imagine this gorgeous rose, you know, you're looking at these petals unfurling and at the center of it is just decay and disease and awfulness. You know, here you have this beautiful thing. And then in the core of it, this awful, hellish thing. And I always felt for years like I was the rot in that rose. Like I was the warm, death center of this gorgeous thing, you know.
Oh my God.
Is that imagery something that you have held inside for years, or is this a new analogy?
Yeah, it still pops in my head. It still pops in my head more now as a reminiscence kind of thing, not as an active condition of or an active observation. I very much feel like the rose now.
I have a thing with visual with an onion. You know, an onion when I make making dinner and all of a sudden you're chopping and it's like a nice, beautiful onion. And then you chop through it and then like this flower you speak of, there's just this piece of shit, rotten. And you're like, God, you're so beautiful, all of you. And there's just this core layer. I just wanted to share that with you onto the flower.
No, it's perfect. And honestly, an onion is probably more appropriate than a rose for me.
You opened up an onion and it had a little piece of shit in it?
It was like a little piece of shit, like fucking Mr. Hanky from the South Park. Oh, he just jumped on me.
You sure you smell nice and flowery?
And then Tao Lee came and he goes, let's get high. And it was like so much. It was so weird.
What are the names of those onions?
Just a white onion.
Really?
Yes.
Sure. Blame the white onion. I see how it is.
White yeah, onion. Sure. Yeah. Like the white devil. Right.
Go on. Or should I go on?
The privileged onion.
Yes.
Let's continue with the produce. Yeah, the privileged produce.
So I spent years and years and years feeling like everything's great. I feel like shit. I could legitimately have fun sometimes. And then I would want to go crawl into a cave for 3 weeks. And at the time, probably when that was getting to be at its worst, was right around the time I met Heidi. And right around the time she stopped calling you back because she was trying to figure out how to contend with this dude she'd met, who she liked a lot, who made her laugh and seemed like he was fun. And
how long after you guys met? I mean, you obviously were having a good run for a while, maybe because you met her. But if you are acted that way in the first couple of weeks, she'd be like, fuck this guy. She fell in love with you. And then there was no turning back, right? I would assume.
I put up very substantial walls between me and her when we met because I liked her a lot from the first minute. Great irony. I met her literally like 2 weeks after I decided I wasn't going to date anyone anymore, you know, that I was just going to get high. And
that's how it always works.
Right. Yeah. I'm just going to get high and play video games and, you know, burn the rest of my 20s into oblivion. And then I met her and I went, God.
I love that you planned that.
Yeah. No, I very much so. It's one of the few things I actually actively took agency.
You like wrote it down and like checked off the list, right?
Yeah, I had been whimsical up to that moment. And then I was so dedicated. Yeah. And then she showed up and wrecked the whole plan with her awesomeness. But I kept her very much at a distance. And I was afraid to let her know me completely because I thought all I can do is hurt this girl. That's the end game, is me hurting her in one way or another. And I was very tired of making women cry. And I did not want to put her through all that, you know? So I maintained this barrier, you know, I was saying to protect her. I don't know, it's probably to protect me too. And as she started getting closer and closer to me, she started seeing more and more.
How much time had gone by that you guys were seeing each other when she started noticing?
Well, that's probably a better question for her than me, but probably not very long. I mean, maybe a month or two in, when I think she probably sensed that every step closer she came, I took a half a step backwards. And she probably was wondering. I didn't tell her I loved her for like 2 years. And I did love her. I loved her, I mean, incredibly strongly.
To know her is to love her.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, that probably happened a minute after I said, oh, you had me at hello, you know. But I didn't want to say it because I'm like, shit, man. Then we're closer together and then we're nearing the inevitable end. I've joked, and I know people use this line, you know, I never thought I'd live to 30. I had no intention of living until 30. I was going to take extreme action to prevent that from ever happening.
And that showed up in the recreational drug use and doing like very daring physical activities or like what?
Yeah, I never did like, I never bungee jumped, although I would have were the opportunity put in front of me. I'd have jumped out of an airplane. Yeah, see, I wanted to do that too, right up until I had kids. And I'm like, crap, I can't orphan my children. So I'll have to wait until they're adults. But
then the second they leave the house,
I am leaping from a plane. Yes, I will say goodbye to them from 20,000 feet.
You're like on the roof as they're driving away.
That's what I pictured.
Watch my dive.
Yeah.
With a little parachute that you get from like the kids' stores.
Yes, that says goodbye kids on it. And yeah, so I mean, drugs. Yeah, did a few of those for a little while there. I did quite a few.
With the intent to like poison yourself and overdose?
No, with the intent of I can go to a doctor and I can get drugs that have heinous side effects, or I can go to my friend and get drugs that don't seem to. And yeah, I numbed myself from, believe it or not, I didn't smoke pot until I was 18. It was the first time I ever smoked pot. And then I made a concerted effort to not be sober for the next 12 years, pretty much all day, every day, and up to and including when I met my now wife, and even for a few years beyond that.
You ever had that moment where you smoke so much pot that like it's almost novel when you're not high? You're like, oh, this is kind of fun. My brain's like working quickly.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, when I stopped smoking, it was by accident. I was sitting next to her on the couch and I went, huh? She said, what? And I said, I haven't gotten high in like 2 weeks. She went, what? But that's how shocking it was when your wife goes, what? And I said, yeah. She goes, did you quit? And I went, not on purpose. No. She said, do you want to get high right now? And I said, I don't think I do. And just the expression of pure confusion on both of our faces, it must have been amazing. And I think I just kind of forgot to keep getting high.
Because you had smoked so much pot, ironically.
Probably, yeah. But the fact that I had gone 2 weeks without any decision not to, I just got busy. And then I went, oh, yeah, no, I think I'm over it. And I just stopped. I mean, after a career worth, I mean, I could have built houses out of the volume of marijuana and other drugs that I consumed in those days. But you know what? They bought me, in the short run, they bought me a little more time.
And at this point, you're not doing the pharmaceuticals. You reached the end of that.
I had given up on them. There were a couple times in a 10-year period where I revisited them, hopefully, and then was quickly dashed of those hopes. And
it's like dating someone you know you shouldn't date.
Yeah, exactly. You looked so good from over there, but the years have not been kind to you. So yeah, a couple tries. At my worst, you know, I'm like, maybe I should try getting back on Zoloft for a little while. And then I'd work my way out of the hole and then I'd put them away again because it was not working. And I kept it up, man, for a long time. I think mental health, for a lot of people who come to crisis, at least I won't presume for a minute to speak for everybody out there, it's a question of stamina. I kept getting up in the morning and I kept doing the things because I'm like, if I can just make it through today, if I can just make it through tomorrow, if I can just make it through the day after that.
But during those days, are you getting any gold? Are you experiencing connection and joy that allows you to go, okay, I'm getting through the day, but there was also some, there was also some bonus. There was also some plus.
You mean other than just existing?
Yes. Yeah. There were some legitimate positive moments in that decade, you know, from 20 to, well, I'll call it from 18 to 28, right?
Taking stock.
Yes, there were definitely good moments and times where I had fun. I just always felt like, you've heard the phrase, we walk on a carpet of flowers suspended over hell.
Of roses that are have shit in the middle.
Yeah, right. My second floral metaphor of the day. But
with the hot dog.
We walk on a field of onions suspended over hot dog.
We walk on a field of onions. I felt like you were doing a Scottish, like.
A great field of onions suspended as far as you can see, boy.
Right.
So no, I had some good moments, but there was all, it was like counterpoint. Like imagine, you know, you're listening to this Mozart aria being played while some shithead down the street is banging on a trash can with a tree branch, you know, like that. Everything was counterpoint. Like, yes, I'm aware I'm happy right now while something's gnawing my guts to pieces. So it was kind of a perspective issue. You know, I would choose to focus on the positive, but I couldn't fully eliminate and ignore that negative aspect that was like a boat anchor around my head all the time.
Sure. So let's get to the juicier stuff, for lack of a better word, hopefully with flower metaphors abound. But well, speaking of which, you got married, which there were many flowers at. I was there. Lead us through how quickly, because I have a very distinct memory of only within 6 months, big bad thing happened.
Yeah, I got married and I never, from the moment I decided I wanted to ask her to marry me, I had no doubt that that was the right thing to do in my life. We could make another episode out of this, but I've had exactly two religious experiences in my life. One of them got me to not join the military and the other one got me to ask my wife to marry me. And that's one of my favorite stories to tell. I don't want to necessarily bury you with it here. You've probably heard me say it a million times. I found myself in a situation where, very much surprisingly to me, a great big voice shouted in my face, you need to ask her father for permission to marry her. And I thought, I literally sat outside of a house arguing vocally with myself and whoever that voice may have been, finally relenting and saying, okay, well, you answer me this then, smarty pants. How am I going to get him by himself on this of all nights? And the exact moment I said that, he walked out the back door, closed it behind him, and stood right in front of me. And I went, well, here we go. I'm in. So I never doubted that I was supposed to marry my wife. And that has proven to be, you know, the source of the greatest joys in my life. In the short run, we rode the magic wave. And then when we kind of leveled out again, the abyss was still waiting for me. Despite, you know, another wonderful thing that's happened to me, yet another blessing. I've now added incredible wife to my repertoire of amazing things. And I'm just, that rose is still rotten at the center. And
right, right. So you got married in August of 2005. And then by the spring of 2006, I know that it was bleak. Things were
getting harder and harder. And again, the stamina issue. And then too, I had no veil between me and her. We were together 24 hours a day, every day. And it became harder and harder and harder for me to maintain that veil and to try and, it's got to suck. You get married to somebody and then they go into a deep depression. You're like, she had to have been questioning, you know, what am I contributing to this? And
but she also, there was an aspect to knowing what she signed up for. I mean, you even said that you were troubled.
Yes, but I think your stamina as a caregiver starts to wear thin too. You know, I think it was starting to weigh heavily on her. You know, it's kind of like alcoholism. It's a disease, but it's like the only disease you could actually cure yourself if you decide you want to. So all these people who could support you in the short run are like, look, I know you're having trouble and you just, you know, I'm going to help you work through this. After day 197 of this crap, you start getting frustrated and you kind of want to go, get your shit together, man. Get out of bed. You know, you got a job. You're going to lose your job if you don't go to work right now. And I'm, you know, like at a point of going, fuck it. If I could do without that job, then I'll go get another one just like it, which I have done. I did many, many times in my youth. I'd work up until there was a crisis point and I'd go, screw you, I'll go get another job. And I'd bail. And that was becoming harder and harder to do.
So would you bring us into that, the moment of what happened and when Heidi found you?
Yeah. So I had retreated into painting houses as a temporary career choice, which was safe. I didn't have to really deal with people that much. I knew I was proficient enough at it and it paid okay. And it's something I had done years past. And I got into a paint job. And I kept falling further and further behind. And I was in a particularly deep mental rut at that time. I was having to fight even harder than I normally did. Pretty much every hour I was awake. You know, there wasn't, when I said that pendulum kept swinging further and further, this is the furthest it had ever swung. And the backswing was a long time coming. I was waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for the rebound, and it wasn't coming. And another day, I could see the frustration in her eyes every morning. And if I got to work and did anything, I'd come home and she'd say, well, do you want to go do something? And I'd say no. And I just wanted to hide and sleep. And I could see her starting to pull her hair out.
And you're newlyweds at this point.
More or less, yeah, which is still, you know, to imagine what that must have been like for her to go from, you know, one of the happiest days of your life to then nurse mating somebody who just wants to slowly expire. It's not, it can't be an easy thing. So another reason why I kept that wall up for so long and then, you know, finally relented. But we woke up one morning, she had to go to work. I didn't want to go to work. I was laying in bed. She said, you need to get up. And I said, I know, I will. She goes, no, Amy, you really got to get up. And I said, I know, I will. And she looked at my face and I knew she didn't believe me. She knew that the second she walked out of the room, I was just going to roll back over under the covers. And I said, I love you. And she frustratingly says, I love you too. She left for work. And I went, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it anymore. The weight got too much and stamina wore out. And I had promised her and my family, who all of whom have been well aware that I had struggled for a long time. I'd promised it for years and years and years. Don't worry. I'll never do that to you. I'll never do that to you. And that was really why I had lasted as long as I did. And
right. Not because you didn't want to.
Right. Because I just knew the carnage that it would leave behind. You know, what a hot mess.
I can tell you. It's pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a mess. And sometimes you don't even know how big of a mess that is until you start peeling back the layers and go, shit, that's even worse than I thought, you know. So there I laid in bed and I started getting angry about my scenario and more frustrated. And I decided that I had had enough. And I went into the bathroom and I tried to take my own life. And it was remarkably easy at that moment when I finally decided, let's go. And I went for it and would have succeeded were Heidi not to have had a very funny feeling and decided to come home on her lunch break.
What did you do?
Yeah, she came home to what must be an image that she carries with her still. I remember most of it. I don't know what level of detail you want me to get into here. I'll tell you something. Cut coat knives are very, very sharp and they're very, very efficient. And I sat in the bathtub and I put on some Miles Davis and I opened my wrists. And I remember fading out, you know, listening to the music. And then at one point I kind of came to in a moment of confusion. I couldn't see very well and I had no balance. So I tried to get out of the bathtub and I slipped and I made it out of the hallway. And then I remembered what was going on. And I went, oh, yeah, what's happened? Just lay down. It's over with. And so then I laid down and she found me in the hallway. And I remember hearing her come into the apartment and screaming my name. So she walked into a, you know, something that I hope no one else ever has to walk into. And I could hear her and I just kept saying, I'm sorry, you know.
You were saying, I'm sorry, while kind of almost half passed out.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I was in and out of consciousness from there for a few hours. I remember, you know, being in the ambulance. I remember being in the hospital. I remember asking the lady to take the blood pressure cuff off my arm because it really, really hurt. Like imagine when your foot goes to sleep, imagine that times 1,000 or so. And I'm like, look, my arm is killing me. Can you take this cuff off? And she went, no, I cannot because this is what's keeping you alive. And I went, oh, right. Yeah, you're so right. My bad. Sorry for the mess, you know. So then they stitched me up. They did the thing, right? So then I'm in the hospital for a few days on a 5150 with big old mitts around my hands and wrists and can't have shoelaces on your shoes. And you're surrounded by people that make you feel a lot better about your own mental health. Mental hospitals are a very interesting place. Now, granted, I've only been in two, so I won't pretend I am the authority figure on mental institutions, but people there generally are not at their best. You'd be shocked to know. And it shows, you know.
I have firsthand experience.
Yeah. some of the people there, that's the best it's ever going to get for them. And then other people are like me that were in a moment of crisis. And, you know, the American medical system's doing what it knows how to do, which is not much.
Andy said that it vacillated, you know, it was somewhere between not giving a shit slash resentful.
Slash treating you like a toddler.
Treating like a toddler slash or the other end, which is doing whatever they can and to make sure not to get in trouble. That might have been a later development.
Everything that he said, and I would add that there's an adherence to rules, the reasons for which no one knows. Like there are, now you have to stand on the left side of the room. Why to the left? Just stand on the left. You know, like, you don't know, dude. You have no idea why I'm supposed to stand over here. I don't know.
Because fear is calling the shots. It reminds me of the pandemic.
Yes. We're going to impose order. We're going to impose order and the lack of it. And it doesn't matter if it makes any sense or not. You know, hey man, I'm going to smoke one more cigarette. No, you're allowed one cigarette during this break. I'm like, those motherfuckers over there are going to take 15 minutes to smoke their cigarette. I smoked mine too quickly. Can I please have another cigarette? The answer is no. The answer is no. You have ceased being a human being. You are now one of the cattle in our cart here. And, you know, and to be fair, I wouldn't know how to begin to address a facility full of people like myself and like the other people that were in there together and try to come up with a system that works. I wouldn't know where to begin. I don't know. It took me this many years just to sort myself out. So I pretend I know the silver bullet for mental health facilities. I would argue some basic rationale of sensitivity.
Yeah, but there are different patients have a different set of personality traits. I mean, my brother, for the most part, I think was a relative peach when he was in the hospital. And if you were at all a people person, then you would probably love him. And so I guess what I'm saying is that if you're don't go into that industry and practice, if you don't really, really love people, if someone's being a jerk or dangerous or...
That's what Thorazine's for. Yes, by all means.
Yeah, I get it, of course. But like a lot of times that's not the case. And these people are fragile and sensitive and beautiful.
They are. And then sometimes they're a danger to themselves. Sometimes they're a danger to someone else. And sometimes they don't even know the difference. It's a crappy place to be. And it's a crappy state of affairs if you find yourself needing to be there. The second time I was there, I asked to be put there because this is later on down the line.
You did it again? You made another attempt?
No, but I felt that was imminent. And I'm like, I need somebody to get me out of this here. Put me on ice for a couple days because, and then immediately I started complaining that I wanted to be out, you know, get me the hell out of the hospital. You get to a point where you're like, I don't know what's going to work. Let's just keep trying stuff. And therein leads to, yeah, probably the first and final successful aspect of my mental health treatment. They're coming for you, David.
Is that Karen? Or I have to end the podcast on a completely unrelated matter.
Yes. Grab the suitcase and run. But you were here with us the whole time. We're going to pipe in some post audio of you just to make it seem like you were here the entire time.
It's so obviously Karen, right?
Right. Yeah. Anyone who met Karen would associate law enforcement.
Well, she lives in LA.
In LA.
We live in like idyllic, like smaller towns.
Right? I am in the city.
No, I hit a point where crisis was looming again, right? And I'm like, I got to do something. And I looked at my wife and I said, I'm running out of options here. I don't know how to do this anymore. I don't want to go back on medicine. We had watched the utter destruction of another one of my family members at the hands of an overzealous prescriber. And on the heels of this, I'm like, I'm so done, man. I'm so tired of the pharmaceutical merry-go-round roller coaster disaster show.
And where are we in time, in the timeline of how long you'd been with Heidi?
This would have been 2007, I think.
Oh, so it's the year after you try to take your own life.
And this is the part where, funny enough, memory gets a little muddy for me. So I've never been very good at time. Like, I know people who have this mental calendar. I want to shake them and go, I don't have that. I do not. I have to look at my phone to find out what the date is three times a day. I just don't track it. So bear with me if this gets a little muddy. But we went to a psychiatrist. Actually, I had been going to a therapist. I said, hey, man, throw me a bone here. What do you think is the next step? He goes, well, if you don't want to go medication, there's not a lot of other options. He goes, but I do know a doctor here that has other treatment methods. And I said, throw me a bone. What's his number? What's his name? How quickly can I talk to him? So I consulted with him, and he is a practitioner, one of the few of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, formerly known as shock therapy, formerly practiced very differently than the way it is now. And he said, this is an option. He basically gave me, he said, you've tried all these other, you know, serotonin-oriented antidepressants. I'll give you two options. There's MAOIs, another whole family of medications, or there's ECT. And MAOIs, this may sound stupid, but the number of things you can't consume when you're on MAOIs, I'm like, oh, just kill me now. You can't eat cheese. You can never drink, you know, you can't smile in the sunshine anymore because it's, it was just like, gut me. Just go ahead and end it. If I can't have cheese, I don't want to live, right?
I will take that knife.
I will. I'll do it right now. But ECT was the other option. And he explained it in depth and he explained the advances in it that have, you know, happened over the years.
Well, it had suffered from a really bad branding after Cuckoo's Nest.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Sure. That was my only knowledge of it at all. I think that's probably most people's only knowledge of it. And that was simultaneously was and was not an accurate representation of it. There were some barbaric days early on where, you know, let's just keep putting enough voltage through this person until they're compliant. And I do believe that happened.
But I imagine, like with everything else, there's technology. And with the technology is knowledge and, right?
Yes. And just, years and years and years of observational data. You know, there are different ways to administer it. Bilateral, unified bilateral. I'm probably not even going to recall it perfectly here. I mean, it's been some years. As barbaric as it sounds, they give you something to make you sleep, which is really nice. I mean, I tell you what, it's the Michael Jackson Express. I mean, you're like, hey, good to see you. Oh, yeah, I'm gone. It's over in like 6 seconds and then you're waking up. No, they knock you out. And then one of the key things is they give you a paralytic. You have to actually have a guy with an airbag keeping you breathing during that time. The paralytic literally utterly paralyzes your muscles so that you're not, as you seize, tearing muscle tissue and stuff. You know, in the early days, people were literally convulsing so badly that they were damaging their musculature and tearing muscles. And
so were you conscious for the...
Not at all. They give you the shot and you say, see you later. And then the next thing you know, there's this nice guy who brews his own coffee, roasts his own coffee going, hey, good morning. And you go, wow, that's the greatest thing I've ever smelled in my life.
Oh, wow.
They do that for everyone?
At this one facility, they did.
Everybody gets the fresh roasted coffee?
So they would do it at the actual, in the operating room at this hospital, because for whatever reason, they have the right facilities there, to be in the OR was the right place to do it. And so, yeah, you wake up, you feel all right. You're a little groggy, you know, post anesthetic. And that began what was, and my wife could tell you better than me, I think about a 6-week process. So the reasoning behind this, to me, pretty sound. We're, you know, the human brain's a biochemical machine. It's electricity and chemistry. And occasionally it gets dodgy. Sometimes you have bad hardware. Sometimes you have bad software. Well, if your iPhone keeps wigging out, 9 times out of 10, what do? You reset it, restart the thing, turn it off, turn it back on. And that process is essentially what's happening to your body and brain when they do that. It elicits a seizure in your body, a controlled seizure, so you're not damaging yourself. For reasons that are still largely opaque, doctors observe that post-seizure, a tremendous amount of different chemicals are released into your body, and they address unease and inflammation and different aspects in this effort for your body's trying to respond to what triggered this thing, but with a pull out all the stops response. It floods your body with a number of chemicals and also largely just reboots the electrical system. So you're a little punchy for a little bit during that process. You know, the memory is a big issue. And that's one of the things that they warn you ahead of time. Look, there's going to be some degree of memory loss associated with this process. And I was at a point where I said, at this point, what are you taking away from me? You know, 15, 20 years worth of misery. I don't give a shit. Take them. You know, I'll work out the good stuff later if this all works. And they're right. There is some memory loss. But funny enough.
How much?
Well, that's an interesting thing. So in the early days, you don't know. You don't know what you don't remember until someone says, hey, remember this? And you go, huh?
It's like, I'm your mom.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I recognized everybody. I remembered, I thought, pretty much everything. But then Heidi would be talking to me and go, well, like that one time we went to Sedona. And I went, I've never been to Sedona. She goes, yeah, we have. And I went, I don't remember going to Sedona. And she says, yeah, we did. And then the funny thing, though.
Is it like Amnesia where it floods back once she opens the door?
Well, yeah. So the data is, at least in my experience, the data is still in there. It would be, she'd go, so we went with my parents. We met my sister and her husband. No, we rode the train. No, we went outside to have a cigarette on the one. And I went, oh.
It's always the cigarette with Randall.
The cigarette brings it all back together. No, but then this flood of memory came back and I remembered now the whole trip. It was a matter of finding which file cabinet has the data. And that's happened a number of times. It's a hard no right up until one association clicks and then it all comes flooding back. So I may have permanently lost something. If we did, I don't know what it was. I still have pretty good recall of everything that I think I'm supposed to.
I have no, as your friend of 20 years, I have no memory of ever trying to connect with you about something that happened in our lives and you to say that. Now,
not remembering it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you got the treatment done only several years after we met, and those years we were spending less time together. Did it work that the memory loss was only before and not after?
I think the re-scrambling of neural pathways happens during the procedure. And I think that once you've stopped, it's not going to get any worse. At that point, there is a new structure. There's a new route. I'm like, if you imagine the billion train cars that are your neurons that are interconnected, you used to go this path to get to that data. And now you have to go a different path to get to that data. And so it's all still there. The rearranging, I think, is more or less over at the point you finish the treatment.
And yet, how many sessions did you have, Randall? I'm sorry.
It started, I believe, as 3 times a week for 2 weeks, and then going down to 2 times a week for 2 weeks, and then once a week for 2 weeks. She might be able to correct me in that. It's something of that order. You start off strong, and then you taper off.
And then you were done.
And then I was done. And then there was a period there where, you know, everybody kind of gives you the keen eyeball there, like, okay, what are you up for at this point? And I quit drinking. I didn't smoke pot anymore at that point. I decided to try and start on a completely clean slate. You know, like, let's establish a new normal, a new floor from which you interact with the universe, you know? And so for a year, I was sober as a judge and slowly kind of found myself re-engaging. Yeah, that's not a real accurate.
I know. I'm like, judges seem like they would drink a lot. Yeah. I mean, lawyers drink more than any group of people in existence.
Yeah. I'm going to work on that one.
And they were, you have to be a lawyer to get it right.
Yeah. Man, I chose the wrong line of work. I really did.
Yeah, you did. There's some great liquor.
But I just tried to get a new baseline. You know, like, I don't even know, where's my normal day now, right? What does a normal day look like for me? I didn't know at that point. It had been so scrambled, so muddied for so long. But I just, day after day, every day was a little better than the last. And it took me a little while to reengage with the working world. You know, I wasn't, certainly in those first few days after, was not going to crush a job application or an interview, you know. But I just kept putting one foot in front of the other, and in a relatively short order, kind of came back to the myself that I know and that everybody else knows. And I've had bad days since then, like everybody does. And I've had good days since then, like everybody does. I haven't had a day that I felt inordinately depressed when everything was right.
Your bad days were a lot better than they used to be. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
I have, since then, I've never had that scenario again where everything's right. Why do I feel like shit?
And well, and also, I thought that was interesting timing, because when did Heidi get pregnant with Lily?
In early 2009. So it was a couple years. It was a couple years after that. There's no way in hell I was going to father a child at that stage of my life. It was not going to happen.
No, of course. The level of gifts that you saw, though, a couple of years later, were, you know, you could argue on a level of thing, something you had not seen or experienced yet.
True. Although I recognized those things were out there. Even at my worst, I'm like, oh, what a great, wonderful thing that'll be for someone else that is not a hot mess. You know, I never thought I'd live long enough to have children. I never thought I'd live long enough to be married. I knew myself well enough to know that I just didn't have that kind of stamina. There was no way I was going to pull it off.
Do you recall, I know your memory's hazy, but do you recall a moment in some months, weeks, months, or a year after the treatment where you went, oh shit, this is going to be okay. Like, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah. Oh, incrementally, that happened a lot. You know, first you kind of hold your breath, you know, like, okay, the treatment's done. We're gonna all hold our breath a little bit. And everybody would kind of tiptoes around you, you know. How you doing, Randall?
You're pretty close to that rope.
What's shaking? Can I get you a Pepsi?
Step away from the Cutco.
Yeah. And credit, man, credit to everybody in my family and my wife's family. They were valiant through that whole process. And I don't think my wife's family was prepared for what I for what I brought to the table in that respect. And to their credit, they all stood up and just exceeded anyone's expectations, including their own, I think, of how to assist somebody in reengaging with normalcy.
Was there a learning curve there to find that comfort?
For them and for me. Something that I contended with afterwards was accepting that it was all right to feel good now. I had a couple times where I felt guilty, and I had had this before too, for instance, I was painting a guy's house and ended up, this is before I decided to kill myself, but I fell apart and couldn't finish this job. And I had to call him up and go, look, I'm sorry, I'm halfway through. Your house looks shittier now than when I showed up, right? Because I've pressure washed half of it. I'm like, please take your money and give it to somebody else. Find another painter. I can't fucking do it right now. And it was awful, right? I mean, like, but I'm at a point at that time where I'm like, I'm going to run screaming from the room if I have to do one more day of this. And so few weeks goes by, I start feeling better. Heidi says, hey, so-and-so is having a poker night. This guy goes to our church, is having a poker night. Do you want to come to the poker night? And I went, yeah, you know what? I think I can do that.
The guy you did that to with the house?
No. Totally different guy.
Oh, okay. Like, I would invite you to not go over there.
Well, I walk in the door. I'm like, man, this will be the first time I kind of went out and had fun in a while. And guess who is there? Is the guy whose house I fucked up.
It is a guy.
And it was like getting punched in the belly. I'm like, oh, fuck. I can't have fun in front of this guy. I can't, you know, hey, sorry about your house. Want another beer? You know, like I felt it was awful. And that's a difficult thing to navigate is, you know, you've put people through a crisis, whatever magnitude, and then you get better. It can be tricky to reengage and to allow yourself to have fun and be happy. Because you're like, now am I going, hey, remember all that terrible shit? Well, I feel better now. Let's party. And my thought is the rest of them going, yeah, we're not quite over this yet. You know, what you put us through. People be well within their rights to still have a lingering resentment to the hot mess that you created.
But that's you just being such a mensch to still have that burden and awareness, you know? As opposed to, thank God I feel good. Sorry about your house and life that I ruined.
But that's how it felt, you know. Not every day and not with everybody. I mean, there was a level of intimacy I had with my family and with my wife's family, who I consider to be my family, that precluded that. I never felt that with them. I could laugh in their presence and have a good time and not feel guilty about it. But there were a handful of people out there that I felt like I had kind of done wrong to, regardless of whether it was my fault or not. Things still happened. You know, it didn't take away the fact that this guy's house looked like I shit on it.
Did you make your rounds? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, not officially. I didn't do anything official like that. I didn't feel like I had amends to make necessarily. I've apologized to my wife a number of times for having put her through.
To this day.
What I put her through, yeah. I think of anybody that was affected by all of it, she 100% was affected the hardest and was at the front line of ground zero for me. And that's something I wish I could take away from her.
It's so heartening to hear your story, because anybody that knows the two of you as a couple and as a family and has been in your home, which I kind of call a really like a mansion dollhouse. Like if a dollhouse was a mansion.
Emphasis on the dollhouse end of things. Don't give people the wrong idea.
It's so cute. I want to pinch its cheeks. I mean, it's such a perfect house, and you guys come across as sort of the perfect nuclear family. And some of that is true at this point, I think. You do.
We do pretty well.
Spent a lot of time with you at this point, your whole family.
Yeah. And
your whole immediate family.
And had you told me 20 years ago that this would be mine, I'd have laughed in your face, you know, not to think that it was impossible, but it was impossible for me. You know, there's no way in hell that I'll ever be able to keep this kind of thing going. And now I have zero doubt. Every day I wake up, I have a reason to wake up. I have three reasons to wake up beyond my own motivation. And
my whole thing was, after that, doing the shock, what else? Is there anything else that you needed to also do to, so that was it? You were done with all of it?
Yep. I haven't taken any kind of medication since then. And again, I want to be real clear. I mean, if there's somebody out there that's entering into this same sort of a scenario, it may be different for other people.
Yeah, I remember when I called you in desperation when Andy was melting down.
I asked if it was appropriate for Andy, you know, and the doctors said no because of the type of psychosis that he was suffering from at that time, that it was counterindicated. And that may well be. I know there are a lot of doctors that are very reticent, and they even some very well-educated doctors out there that look at it as barbarism or barbarity or whatever, you know, that don't attach a therapeutic value to it.
Well, that's what I find very interesting, because there's no doubt that it suffered from such a horrible reputation. And it does feel like, with how hand in glove the pharmaceutical industry is with the medical community now, and you see such just devastating fallout from the pharmaceutical industry and the taking of it. And your story just is, to me, is this sort of just totally standard, normal story of experience with pharmaceuticals.
I will say that for some people, a pharmaceutical answer is okay.
Yeah. And we're going to have those people on our podcast to discuss that.
You know, like, I'm a big fan of Eastern medicine, right? I believe in the power of meditation and acupuncture and diet and holistic approaches to things. You're not going to holistically get yourself through appendicitis. You know, there's a day where you need a fucking doctor.
Right. My arm fell off. Just meditation is really the answer.
You're not going to acupuncture your way through type 1 diabetes. I mean, there's a time and a place for everything, and there's a value to everything. And Western medicine does have some tools that have never been before available. The problem is when that is your only tool. When all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, you know? And I think there are some hammer-wielding nutcases out there with a medical degree. One in particular that I went to that I had another family member go to, and I had recognized already that this doctor was essentially a drug dealer and not with any sort of Hippocratic obligations to her at all, and did not know early on that my other family member was being seen by the same doctor. And when I realized that, strongly advised against going any further down the road with that doctor. Unfortunately, I was not listened to, but this family member of mine was 12, 13 years old and taking 7 different medications a day.
Yeah. When we found Andy's stash we picked it up from the hospital after he had passed away, his stash was 7 different medications in his little Ziploc bag.
And you got one for this and one to stop that side effect and then one to address this side effect. And you're just chasing your tail at that point.
Absolutely.
I'm a firm believer, if you ever wake up one morning and you're taking 7 medications, take a good look at all this and say, we need to start over. There may be a better way to go about this. It may be at the end of the day that you need those 7 to survive. But I would say, mentally speaking, most people don't. You've gone too far down the rabbit hole at that point.
As it relates to ECT, it feels like, of course, it's not for everyone, but it may be for a lot more people than are currently using it.
I would say that's a safe statement.
That's what I would say.
Yes.
Because you are the only person I even know of that's ever done it.
I am the only person that I know of that's ever done it. I don't know anybody else.
Right.
We don't have a group on, we don't bowl together on Tuesday or anything. You know,
ECT, shock therapy group, right.
Not that it's likely to come up in so how do you feel about ECT? You know, go Dodgers.
Well, there's that too. Would anyone openly say that they did?
I hope so. I hope they will.
I hope so too.
Randall's has no reason to be ashamed. He doesn't seem like he is. It seems like he's proud of it. And that's why I wanted to have you on to discuss it.
I said to my wife from a hospital bed, no secrets. I said, there can't be any secrets about this. I said, people are going to ask what happened. To the degree you're able to tell them what happened. I said, if you don't want to, I'll tell them. I said, but I don't want this to be a secret. And I made a pact with myself then that if the day ever came where I could have a conversation with somebody and I could bring my own experience to bear, that I would take that opportunity and I would be as transparent as I could about things with that person. And
what I love about it is that maybe I shouldn't use this word, but there's something almost holistic about it.
I think I see what you're saying.
In that it's electricity, that we are already made of some electricity, as you said, and you are rewiring the system, but you're not putting in on a daily basis crap, much of which has things that the human body doesn't want. And there is a great cost to.
You're just inciting a seizure. It's like you're hitting a reset switch. It's actually a remarkably low amount of electricity, and it happens to just be carefully placed at certain points where it's going to trigger that seizure. They used to do it with insulin. They would cause a seizure with insulin, and that's clearly not without its dangers, you know, but the idea was the same. We don't know why a seizure does these wonderful things for the body, but if we can make it happen in a controlled environment and they don't hurt themselves, we may be onto some. When they did what they call modified bilateral with me, so it was on one temple and then on the chin with the other electrode. So you're not blasting both temples, and that bilateral, that, you know, when you're hitting both temples, is associated with much more memory loss, much more heavy baggage coming out of it, you know.
And that's a later development in the in the practice? Right. So that's what I meant by technology and more knowledge down the road, that it's sounds like it's probably a lot less barbaric for a number of reasons.
I found it to be amazingly
life-saving.
Pathetic and, well, yeah, I mean, I...
right? I mean...
I firmly believe I would not be sitting here now were it not for that procedure. You know, it's not for the faint of heart, and it's not something you dive into that decision, and it's not something you can do by yourself. They won't even let you leave without someone to drive you home. You know, you're all wonked out and kind of hazy for a while, but I don't know. I mean, other people have asked me, are there long-term side effects? I'm like, you tell me, man. I don't know. I'm unaware of them. I think you probably see roughly the same person that you used to prior to that whole process. Arguably a better version of me, because I'm not weighed down with this colossal, you know, anchor hanging around my soul.
May cause children.
May cause
white picket fence.
Happiness.
Nice house.
Yeah. Yeah. Warning. May cause great white American dream.
The condition out is hot dog fingers.
Yeah.
Well, that's your favorite one.
I know.
Yeah.
I actually did have a hot dog finger situation when I was taking something for like the neuropathy. And I'd be like, my hands would feel like sausages. And I wouldn't say hot dog.
Did you blow up? Did you retain fluids?
It didn't look different, or it felt claustrophobic in my own body kind of feeling.
And nowhere to go.
Yeah. And I was like, and my feet, I like feel like sausage hands. And they go, what are you talking about?
You sounded almost like your mom the way you did that.
It was like sausage hands. Yeah, I guess it kind of did. It did a bit, just a little bit.
This has been fun. Fun is not often something that one uses to describe discussion of mental health, but it is that. And to me, it's liberating. And to me, it's one of the few gifts I feel like I could potentially give is, you've heard the phrase, he who saves one life saves a world entire. I mean, and that to me is, I'd like to think that maybe someday in my life, I could save that life, you know, and give somebody a glimmer of hope.
I mean, that's why my heart's on fire to do this podcast, that in the wake of losing Andy, I was just sort of like, I got to do something. And I have so much to say, as we know. And I want to sound...
What'd you say? I wasn't listening.
I'll kill you.
Sorry.
And I think having these conversations that everybody is starting to have more and more and getting it out there, we can all, Karen and I and you and whoever we have on, can have this conversation and facilitate these conversations, because, you know, there's got to be a better way, a better pill.
It only gets easier. Once you crack the seal on it, a lot of times the words just come flowing out of people. And the hardest word is the first word. You know, like the hardest step is the first step. It just open up and let it pour out. And maybe we find ourselves looking back on this and going, God, do you remember how the world used to be back before everybody talked about it?
Back before David started talking.
Yes. God, the good old days.
Most people would say that's a worse place to be after.
No, you know, it's like everything. It's just a half a glass, David. It's neither full nor empty. It's just a half a glass. Thank you guys for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you so much for sharing and being so brave. And this is why we're here, because sharing stories like this is, I believe, how we all can get a little better. All right, don't go away. We're gonna talk a little shit on Randall. Well, that was relatively fascinating. I mean, Randall's been in our life for many moons at this point. Did you know about that?
Not to this degree. No.
Yeah. But had I told you that he had had electroshock therapy before we did this podcast, you didn't know that?
No.
First of all, I find it brave that he shared that. And it shouldn't be as brave as it is, but it's the stigma in our culture of the way that we look at that. And I mean, that's just all part of the problem, that the only trusted methodology is taking pills. And it's like, there's a lot of options out there.
Right. Cause you think it's very primitive when they say when they say electroshock therapy, you're thinking, ooh, they're putting, it's so Renaissance.
Barbaric. Right.
Yeah. Like torture chamber. But bless him, he described one here at the temple and the other one over. It was a lot. It was very insightful. And it's incredible that it actually helped him. And no one talks about it.
No. And I think there's a lot of advancements that have been made. And I find it very interesting the way that we're made up of electricity. And he said that. And I don't think that I was necessarily aware of that. And when you think of it that way, it sort of changes the whole perspective of this, which is you're rebooting, the system, the iPhone system that is your body and brain.
Defibrillating it.
Yeah.
You're giving it a thing. You're right.
That was a callback of my ignorance from second podcast. Right? Thank you so much.
Yeah. It's just a reboot. You're right. It's like a recharge. It's like, system update.
Yeah. And there is something oddly holistic about it. It's like just this sort of rewiring. And I just think it's funny that one of the main reasons why it was taken off the table for our culture was because of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it's like, it's a movie.
I haven't seen it in my olden age.
In your olden age? Is that what we're in?
Yeah.
Are we in Karen's olden age?
This isn't my olden age, my golden girl's pond.
An episode wouldn't be complete without a mention about the Golden Girls, would it?
I realize I speak a lot about the Golden Girls. It's been brought to my attention.
This is going to be one of those things where it's past the penny in theater. You try to get it into every episode.
I don't try. It's in every part of my orifices.
It is. And I love each and every part of it. But what I'm saying is that we live in such a movie, cinema-centric culture that something as simple as a movie, which by the way, was not necessarily really even based on a true story. I believe Nurse Hatchet, who's the evil bitch in it, was, from what I have researched, but it's a made up story. And so it's not it's even based on a true story. And yet, because of what happens in that with the shock therapy to the main character, it's a terrible thing, it's barbaric, and must still be that way. And I think that's a shame. And I want to spread the word that for certain people, maybe it's a better pill, right?
It shouldn't be taken off the table. I mean, listen, when he was describing his youth, being so young and little and knowing something was wrong, when he was describing his experiences and just sleeping all day and kind of trying to hide it from his parents and not having a big group of, just dealing with regular 12-year-old, 10-year-old bullshit. And then this thing, and he's gone through the alphabet soup of pills, all these medications, and nothing is sticking, or he can't get back to that feeling he needed initially. It's like when all else fails, finally he's like, okay, let's give this, what else is left to lose? And it does sound like of all of the stuff that he has gone through and all the stuff that he's tried, that this final thing that seems so insane and barbaric was the thing to help him. Like, I think he's off of everything and like he's able to have a...
It's both beautiful. And my strong hunch is that if I was there in the room, it would not strike me quite as barbaric as it's been painted, as it's made out to be. I mean, and sometimes you have to go through something kind of difficult in the moment to see the payoff. You know, like that, when we talk about like the come up on mushrooms can be really uncomfortable for people and really ground shaking in a negative way. But the experience during and after can be where the beauty comes. It's like you work hard at the beginning and then there's payoff. Whereas, you know, it seems to me that a lot of the time it's feel good for a lot of pills is feel good now, pay later. And maybe it's pay up front, do the work up front, and then you feel better. I mean, I don't have any experience with obviously ECT, but you know, I did ayahuasca. I walked into the Amazon jungle in 2016 and puked my fucking guts out.
I love this story.
I think I tallied, I threw up 30 times.
You were saying puking and shitting at the same time. Like each hole was working.
That never happened. It happened for some people.
Okay.
No. It was one or the other. And also I had some control over my bowels. And I thought maybe it was not the best look to shit in front of a bunch of people in a dark room. Color me crazy.
You're so sweet. Thinking about
I think this time I'm not going to shit my pants in front of people. It didn't work out last time.
As if you have any control of your own movements and what's happening going in through this trip.
Well, it's the idea of you purge your darkness on a molecular level. And it is its own kind of organic version of the rewiring that it seemed like Randall was doing. You know, contrary to popular belief, it was not pleasant. This experience I had was terrifying, and no uncertain terms, terrifying. And I ran into a medicine man on my way out of town, and it sounds like the beginning of a song.
Yeah, it sounds like you're screaming. Like I could just see you like running naked and like just screaming and looking behind you and through the, you know, jungles.
It was a very humbling experience, and we're gonna dive deeper into the whole ayahuasca.
Yeah, we need to dive into this one too.
Really deep work and very hard work. And the point that I'm making though is that he said, I pictured what you just said, that I'd come out of the jungle whistling a tune, wanting to like take on the world and like, you know.
Look at me now, Ma.
Yeah, exactly. Gotta dance. Right. become Gene Kelly. Like tap dancing out in a sailor uniform.
Oh, that's so sweet. With a lamppost, you're just dancing. And
right. It's like, why is there a lamppost in the middle of the Amazon jungle?
It's just, you know, it appears because you have been rewired. So now you see things as you want. So it's just a tree.
It is. If you do the right work in ayahuasca, a lamppost will appear. So you may do an outstanding Broadway musical number.
Amazing. Alone. Alone, where
and
no
more
one
alone
see.
Than ever after you're done, right? I digress. My point is that he said it's not about during. You can have an amazing experience during, but it's work and it's a rewiring. And start paying attention to the things that happen in your life over the next year to a year and a half. And sure enough, I went in with my intention into the jungle to find my woman, to write the first version of my book. I won't say what you don't want me to say, memoir, any memoir. And to have my real estate career be in a new place at a better firm. And right before the buzzer of exactly the time mark, all of those things happened. And I wasn't paying attention to it. I was not cognizant of that as I was walking, you know, living my life, of being like, somewhere along the way, a year and a half later, I was like, well, I'll be damned. You know, I don't normally talk like that.
Things are unfolding. Yeah. Like things were coming out roses.
Yeah. And it really was like, shit, was I rewired and I took a left instead of a right? And I made different decisions in my life in a natural, organic way because I had purged some of my trauma and my darkness on a molecular level that made me make bad decisions before. And that's the whole idea. Same with like Randall is like, not just making bad decisions, but going to dark places because he's been rewired. I think a lot of people are impervious to therapy. You know, they say, that's what they say. And I can just say that from a family that talks all the time about their feelings, I do wonder, is there any real value in just sitting down and say, like, we always are talking. But if you're always talking about your feelings, it's not going to be a big fucking deal if all of a sudden you say more of your feelings.
Right. Right. Yeah. I don't know.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. I mean,
I got into an argument with a peripheral friend a couple of years ago, and he was saying how helpful therapy is. And I was just, my experience had been like, no. And he was like, it's been incredible for me. And I sort of like pushed back at it. And I was like, how do we know that, like, you know, does it do anything? And I'm thinking afterwards, he's not the kind of person that has to say every fucking thing, every little feeling, and process every emotion that comes into his head the way that I do. And so it made sense to me that he found therapy really valuable because he doesn't get to share those feelings. And so when he's having that opportunity.
Then, right. For me, it was a learning thing. It was, yeah, I can talk, but being able to actually communicate also takes the listening part, you know, after, you know, having postpartum.
I'm sorry?
Sorry. Eat shit and die. After having postpartum, you know, so that like put us into a whole, like it shifted the whole relationship. So how I spoke, how we spoke, how we communicated, the back and forth, you know, like that was very eye-opening in that we did need the help to not, just like you're saying, it's rewiring what your usual status quo is to now not putting up a defense wall and now kind of like making yourself more open and more vulnerable, even if you are already vulnerable, but in order to keep the communication and the talking going. So there is good and bad, and we all kind of learn as we go. But even for me, as a chatty Cathy, as you like to call me, it did help. It helped. The more you know. Ding!
And da-da-da! Shut the fuck up!
Blah, blah, blah. Yes.
No, wait, wait. I mean, first of all, I never call you chatty Cathy, do I?
You've called me a chatty Cathy a couple times.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, I'm not Cathy, I'm Karen. And it's with a K, and it's not that Karen.
Oh, I know. Well, that's what I tell people because I'm so defensive now because your name has become that label.
Yeah, I'm that.
And I'm like, she's really good.
Yeah, it's Karen.
Karen. Right. You got to do the Israeli glottal.
You got to get the smachta in your throat. You got to go, Karen.
You said her name wrong. Right.
You said it wrong. If there's no, yeah. The Karen. That's not me.
Karen. It's all the money we had, Karen.
That's my favorite when people just throw that at me. I love it. But let's just loop around, like take the horse, go this way. Thanks so much for Randall, because this was really eye-opening. And I, like you said, like it is very brave. It sucks that it's still looked at as that. Like so many people need help and some direction. So that was fucking amazing having him, you know, give us his experience and how great it is.
Yeah.
I feel like you want to embrace in a kiss right now through the video.
Come in for kissy kiss, as you would say.
Tell me.
No, I mean, I'm hoping that we can have more of those like warm and fuzzy success stories. It's not going to be that a lot. It's going to be a lot of just train wrecks. No.
Train wrecks and searching, still searching. Yeah, I know. Right. But as long as we're searching, we're here to search.
That's good work.
Get your magnifying glass, bitch. We're about to go look.
Fry those ants.
Not on the sun, bitch.
Burn those ants. You know what I'm doing?
Yes. Mommy, I did it again. That's how Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again came about.
What?
No, can you imagine? It's like, Oops, I did it again. And she was burning with the magnifying glass.
That's what you thought, right? That was the initial inspiration for that song.
It started with She Broke Hearts, and then it became, shoot, I'm hurting the ants. Searching.
You know, never in my life would I have expected this conversation to go this off the rails this fast.
So off.
Which I should have learned by now, you know, is the case. And with that, I'm David Niemann.
I'm Karen Basson.
And this has been A Better Pill.
To Swallow.
Yeah.
I have to do a shout out to Brittany, Mama. Brittany.